Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants. Welcome to the JAPA podcast for the April 2019 issue. In this podcast, we summarize select articles from this month's JAPA. I'm your co-host, Christopher Madej, Program Director at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center PA program in Memphis, Tennessee.
And I'm your other co-host, Adrian Banning, faculty member, research coordinator, and EBM course director at the Drexel PA program in Philadelphia. This month, we feature CME articles on wound management, long-acting contraception, acetaminophen toxicity, and cubital tunnel syndrome.
Yep, a good mix of things as always. I know we keep saying that every single episode, but this is what makes JAPA so good at what they do, is it's a little bit of something for everyone. Mm-hmm. So our question from the editor for this month is, as PAs, our medical practice is often influenced by laws and policies as much as it is by the latest scientific research. Sometimes, however, these rules have unintended consequences and can even be obstacles to patient care. If you could change or remove one federal, state, or institutional law or policy that directly or indirectly affects PA practice, what would it be and why?
This is a really good question. I think it calls for a specific answer. A couple months ago, we learned that PAs got more rights at the national level due to the direct advocacy efforts of AAPA for hospice care. And PAs got more rights in hospice care than ever before, but we still have a couple restrictions, and then we're more restricted than our physician colleagues and our nurse practitioner colleagues. And I think that especially in primary care, when you're following a patient for so long and you come to a point where you're going to be part of someone's end of life experience, to have your interactions limited just by the legality of it, that's bothersome to me. So I think that's something that I would say I would want to change and just have us have the same abilities and permissions as our other colleagues in hospice care.
No, I mean, that's definitely a good one. And it was something that we had, Adrian and I have discussed, as well in terms of the, overview of hospice medicine and those kind of things. And again, a lot of it just comes down to equality, right? We just want to be created equal and be able to take care of our patients the best that we can under the laws that are currently in place. And if we feel like those laws don't allow us to be able to practice at that level, then we need to be able to advocate to adjust, change, or remove in order to be able to do that. So mine is actually much more education-driven, and I know it's something that AAPA advocacy is working towards, but for those of you that maybe don't follow the education circles, PA students can actually not write notes that are co-signed by their physician for Medicaid and Medicare. Those, if they have a preceptor who sees those patients, they can't just use the note written by the student. They have to actually write a whole nother note and do that themselves, which kind of takes a little bit of the benefits of having a student on your service, because your student can go and pre-round, write all these notes, get them all ready for the assessment and plan, and then the preceptor can come by and say, I agree with the note written by, you know, PAS so-and-so as above, except for the changes below, and then they put in their assessment and plan. So they actually, that had affected all students up until a few months ago. But they changed those laws, but unfortunately, they changed them for medical students only. So PA students and nurse practitioner students still cannot do that. And so they're still advocating to get those laws changed to be able to get students to be able to do that and write those notes because, again, we're clinical rotations are at a premium in PA education. And the more that we can really showcase how a student can make you be more efficient is going to be very, very helpful. And this is one law that is really affecting those particular practices, especially if you see a lot of Medicare and Medicaid patients. So that's what I would do.
And if you have the choice between, all right, I have one slot to take a medical student or a PA student or a nurse practitioner student, I'll take the medical student because at least that helps me go a little bit faster. And then we're just in more of a bind. That's a really good point, Chris. Yep. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yep. Yeah. So those are just two that Adrian and I picked out. I'm sure that you all who are listening have your own, but all the more reason to see what the advocacy group for AAPA is doing, getting involved where you can and really getting your voice be heard to try to change some things in order to better take care of our patients.
Yeah, that's the point. If you feel strongly about something, you can't just talk about it. You have to take action. We have to move into a future of PAs being actively engaged in advocacy, philanthropy, in scholarship and research. This is the next generation.
Absolutely.
Okay. That was my opinion. So disclaimer, and another disclaimer, this podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition. We share our take and opinions, and they do not represent JAPA, the authors or the editor's opinions or the publisher. And this is not intended as medical advice.
And do not forget, we always cover the CME articles that are in each month's issue. So make sure that you go online to review the post-test and score at least a 70% to get your Category 1 CME credit. So don't listen to us, always listen to us, but don't let the CME credits on the wayside. Make sure you go and log those.
Do you know, Chris, as I was preparing this month's show notes, I was like, man, I wish there was a way I could just kind of like listen to a summary of these articles as I wait. That's what I do. So, if anyone out there wants to like pre-podcast this from this podcast, no, I'm kidding.
To go back to the student analogy, we need somebody to pre-round before we round to get that information to you guys, the listener. So if you're interested in pre-rounding for us, please let us know.
Yeah. We would actually love to interview as many people as possible. So if you do want to be on the podcast, shoot us an email or tweet at us. But in the meantime, we're going to jump into the CME, yeah?
Yeah.
All right, cool. The first CME article we're going to talk about is Helping Patients Select Long-Acting Reversible Contraceptives, and that's by Talia Sierra, PAC. She's an assistant professor in the PA program at Idaho State University in Caldwell, Idaho, and she has no conflicts of interest to disclose. So she starts off by telling us that up to 45% of pregnancies are unplanned, so it's really important to consider IUDs and subdermal implants for patients as a viable, safe, and approved long-term birth control option. So long-acting reversible contraceptives like IUDs, like the subdermal implants, we're going to call them LARCs from now on for long-acting reversible contraceptives in this summary. Some providers might not think about them as first line, depending on their training. For example, side note, I was taught years and years ago to only use IUDs after the woman had already had the kids that she wanted to have, and that's not the case at all anymore. This is a great first line option for adolescents and women who have not had a vaginal delivery. They are good candidates for IUDs. The author points out that the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Society of Adolescent Health and Medicine actually recommend LARCs as first-line contraception in many adolescents and young adults. Okay, so the breakdown. There are 5 IUDs available in the U.S. All of them are more than 99% effective at preventing pregnancy. 4 of them have hormones, and 1 does not. We're going to go over them in a little bit. You should place them within the first week after the woman's last menstrual period, or you can place them during menses. And you should be aware that 3 of the IUDs have been approved in the last 5 years, so they might be new to you if your training on this was more than 5 years ago. There is a little bit more cost up front, more than a pack of birth control pills, but then because you have them in for years, then their cost actually becomes one of the most affordable and effective options because they last for so long. You do have to test for pregnancy first, and you also have to remind patients to use a barrier method like condoms during sex to prevent STIs because LARCs don't protect against STIs. They're also a really great option for women who can't use estrogen in their birth control or for women who've had a thrombotic event and can't take OCPs. There are some contraindications, though, to IUD specifically. If you have abnormal uterine bleeding, a current pregnancy, an active pelvic infection, or any anatomical distortions of the uterus like a septate uterus or bicornate uterus, uterine fibroids, etc., IUDs aren't for you. What else can go wrong with them? The pelvic inflammatory disease risk is increased in the first year. They think it's correlated to the actual insertion of the IUD. But then after that, it's comparable to the general population. The IUD can spontaneously come out. That happens in about 1 in 20 placements. There can be uterine perforation. That happens in about 1 to 2.6 out of 1,000 placements, so pretty rare. The IUD can get stuck. It can get implanted in the uterine wall. That's 10 to 16% of patients. That makes removal harder. There is a risk of ectopic. The actual rate of ectopic in women with IUDs compared to women without IUDs is lower because women with IUDs aren't getting pregnant as often as women without them. But of women who do get pregnant with an IUD in place, the rate of ectopics is higher. But remember that they're over 99% effective, so that's still a low number. Hormonal IUDs, there's four of them, have higher risks of ovarian cysts and perforation. The perforation is especially in lactating women. So keep those things in mind as you're making individual shared decisions. And now let's get back to those five IUDs. There's Mirena, Lileta, Kylena, and Skyla, and that's in decreasing order of levonorgestrel. Mirena has 52 milligrams of levonorgestrel, and you can use it up to 5 years. Lileta has also 52 milligrams of levonorgestrel. You can use that up to 4 years. And Lileta also has a cool origin story aside, in my opinion. That's outside the article. You can Google it for yourself. But I want to shout out to PA Andy Lucas Schmerin for keeping me informed on all things women's reproductive rights and especially on the backstory to Lileta. Hey, Andy. Okay, so now getting back, the third one is Kylena. That has 19.5 milligrams of levonorgestrel. Never thought I'd say the name of that hormone so much, but there you go. And you can use that for up to 5 years. And then finally, we move on to Skyla. It's the actual smallest in size of the IUDs, and it has the lowest hormone level at 13.5 milligrams of levonorgestrel. You can use that for up to 3 years. The last one that we didn't talk about of the five is the non-hormonal IUD. That's a copper IUD. Sounds very Star Wars to me. And it has no hormone. And you can use that for up to 10, but maybe even 12 years. So that's pretty cool. The four with hormones all have the same hormone. It's all the levonorgestrel, and that works by thickening cervical mucus and impeding a sperm from reaching the egg. And it also can reduce menstrual flow, may lead to amenorrhea, which some people really like. More levonorgestrel means a higher rate of amenorrhea. You could see spotting, but that tends to lessen over time. The other category of LARC that we haven't talked about yet, we talked about all the IUDs, is the subdermal implant. In the U.S., we only have one that's approved, and that's etonogestrel subdermal. It's a good first-line pregnancy prevention option for women who can't use an IUD, and bonus, it might help with the dysmenorrhea associated with endometriosis. It goes in the inner upper arm. You can use it for up to 3 years. Like IUDs, it also thickens cervical mucus, inhibits sperm migration. It's also over 99% effective. But you have to be specially trained to insert it, and the manufacturer offers that 2-hour training. It's less invasive placement since it's going in your arm and not your cervix, but irregular menstruation could happen, and that menstruation, the irregularity is less predictable than with an IUD. It's also harder to get out than an IUD. It has kind of similar side effects and risks, but with slightly different rates. You cannot use the subdermal implant if you have a hormone-responsive condition like breast cancer or any other hormone-responsive condition. IUDs need a 4-week follow-up after placement, and women should also check for the string that comes off the IUD and hangs just slightly out of the cervix to make sure it's there and where it should be, and that you should do that monthly. There's no need to check anything with the subdermal. So the overall takeaway is that birth control is an individual decision, but you as a provider need to share all the facts with your patient for the best shared decision making. And LARCs are a great first line option. This article really gives us a great brush up and overview of them.
No, I mean, this is one of those things where I think that OCPs are tough to keep track of if you don't consistently prescribe them because of all of the different hormones and concentrations and, you know, dosing schedules and all that other stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think the long actings are really starting to come into play, mainly just because I think the education to not only providers, but also to the patient population is so good just saying, look, if you're not in a period of your life where you're ready to, you know, have a child, then mm-hmm. here's an option that, you know, we can do that could prevent you from getting pregnant. until the time is right for you from a family planning standpoint, as opposed to constantly getting prescriptions and constantly taking oral contraceptives and all the complications mm-hmm. that go with it. So I think
same
these are
great. Same time, every day, gotta mm-hmm. get them, get to the pharmacy. It's way more convenient, it's easier. You know, all birth control has some side effects and risks, but you wanna go over that. And the author makes a great point of saying that if you do feel like it's time to have kids, return to reproductive viability after removal is pretty quick.
Right.
So it's not gonna be an inhibiting thing.
Yep. And at the risk of oversharing, I am actually an IUD baby, so I can...
Are you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. My mom had a copper IUD when back in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. I was born in 1980 and, you know, apparently got pregnant 2 years into it, and, you know, they...
1 out of 100, apparently.
Yep. I am just the Chuck Norris of PA educators. Just didn't care anything about that. It was my time.
The so, Chuck Norris of PA educators from the womb, apparently.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
So right. That was an easy segue right into the next CME article, Making Better Wound Management Decisions. And this was by authors Amy Keim and James Marinucci. Amy is a emergency medicine PA and director of the acute and traumatic wound management education for the Department of Emergency Medicine at GW University in D.C., and James is the former director of trauma technology and wound management for the same department at GW. So just a quick recap of wound healing. So remember that there are lots of risk factors that go into how a wound heals and how you need to manage it. So first and foremost is the location. So well-vascularized areas heal much quicker than places that don't have as good blood flow, and they also have a lower risk of infection. So face, neck, scalp, typically things that are above the shoulders heal very quickly, low risk of infection, and low risk of any wound healing complications. Now, the infection risk, that really just comes down to what caused the wound. So things that have a higher incidence of infections include bite wounds, both animal and human, jagged wound margins, if it's a stellate wound, like a starburst pattern, if it's a deep wound that goes down into the dermal layers, presence of any foreign body, so if it's a dirty contaminated wound with debris or, you know, other things that could be injected under the skin, and then lacerations that are greater than 5 centimeters. Those have, again, a higher risk of infection. And then the third is just patient characteristics. So patients with diabetes, if they're obese, if they have a degree of malnutrition, you obviously need the protein and the energy stores to be able to heal appropriately. Patients with chronic kidney disease for the same reasons with the protein. If they're immunocompromised, so if they have medications that are on board due to organ rejection, solid organ transplant, those kind of things, that's going to lower their risk or increase their risk of not being able to heal appropriately. And then extremes of ages. So the less than 2, greater than 65 are the two age groups that we worry about wound healing complications. Now, I'm sure we were all taught or learned at some point that there is a golden hour of or golden period of wound closure of, hey, if it's been within this certain time frame, we shouldn't do anything with this because we're outside of that particular area. So in 2013, Cochrane did a review that found that there was no evidence to support a quote-unquote time frame for wound closure after injuries. And the article goes into great depths, you know, explaining a whole bunch of things, but it all comes down to their recommendations, which is wounds of the neck, face, and scalp can be closed as if it happened within 24 hours, upper extremities within 12 hours, and lower extremities within 8 hours. So if you see somebody who comes in, you know, 3 or 4 hours after a laceration, it's still fine to clean it up and close it up. So how do we do that? So the preparation for wound closure, there are two cleansing steps that we want to keep straight. The first is the skin prep, which is just cleaning the skin around the wound. But then there's also the wound prep phase, and this is the antisepsis of the wound and the surrounding tissues. Now, the thing that was always beat into me that I always tell my students is that the solution to pollution is dilution. So you want to irrigate the wound aggressively. And this is the first time I actually heard this, but they recommended 50 to 100 cc's per centimeter of wound length. I'd never heard that before. 1 to 2 liters for deeper wounds. But at least it gives you a ballpark of how much are we supposed to be irrigating these wounds. They've referenced that. The other thing that has come out in recent years is that if it's a low-risk wound, if you have somebody who doesn't have any characteristics that this wound can get infected, that using tap water is fine. Most of the filtration systems and just general municipal water is fine to do the irrigation. So you can just take the arm over to the sink, turn the tap on, and just let it irrigate. Higher-risk wounds, they do say that there's really no evidence to suggest that using sterile solution is better than tap water, but they just say, you know what, there's no evidence for it, but sterile saline would be fine to use in your irrigation. Side note, I usually do what I call a poor man pressure bag, and what that entails is you get a bottle of normal saline and a 16-gauge needle, and I just punch a bunch of holes in the cap of the water bottle, and then I use that as my pressure washer. It's low cost. I can put the extremity or whatnot over the sink or in a basin, and then I can just pressure wash it at the bedside rather than getting out the, you know, ridiculously expensive Pulsivac. The other things to keep in mind, gloves, non-sterile gloves are okay. Remember, this was a traumatic wound that was not done cleanly like in an operating room. So it's fine to just use regular non-sterile gloves. You don't have to go out and get sterile, you know, gloves, which increase cost to the patient and really don't show any benefit to not causing any wound healing issues or infection. Sutures, go to the article. They talk about a whole bunch of different type of sutures. We have historically in the emergency settings kind of steer away from using absorbable sutures just because the purpose of them is to absorb over time. And if they absorb before the tissue has had a chance to heal, then it can split back open and cause some problems. But there is some data coming out that says that absorbable sutures may be used in all sorts of traumatic settings. So keep that in mind when you're selecting what sutures to use. Tetanus prophylaxis, just remember anybody who is greater than 5 years since their last vaccine should get a booster at that point. And then antibiotic use, oral antibiotics don't need to be used in all settings. Some of them, depending on the type, obviously a bite wound, those kind of things need to get covered. But if it's just a traumatic wound, it may not need oral or systemic antibiotics, but they do recommend using antibiotic ointment over the sutured wound because it helps keep the wound covered and facilitates in getting the cells and healing at the local level. So it's actually okay to slather the wound with a little bit of antibiotic ointment and telling the patient to do that as well. So nice review of wound management in the acute setting, and certainly some things that might change your practice.
Mm-hmm. I remember learning at a CME conference within the past 2 years that antibiotic ointment gets definitely overused, though. So for the first like 1 or 2 days, but not more than that, because it's one of the most allergen-inducing things that people can buy over the counter and put on. So, but it is one of those things that people can get, so they have that semblance of control, but to be aware, you definitely don't want to overuse that brand name with an N.
Right.
That I won't say, but... Right. and cat bites have to get antibiotics.
Pretty much all bites need systemic antibiotics. Certainly human bites, but animal bites you need to cover as well, just because a high risk of... it's due to the puncture. It's the puncture of the tooth that goes into the skin that just buries bacteria deep. It's really hard to do a really good bedside cleansing at that point. So that's why we typically mm-hmm. cover those. But if it's just a stellate, laceration from something, they mm-hmm. fell, they hit their leg and it split open, those just clean them up, sew them up, and you don't need to get put on antibiotics just because.
All right. Short and sweet. Mm-hmm. The next is a short and sweet too, the QRS on cubital tunnel syndrome. That's by authors Mary Ellen I. Blevins, PAC, and Neda Parnes, MD, and they're at Carthage Area Hospital. Mary Ellen Blevins is a first assistant orthopedics, and Neda Parnes is director of orthopedics. They have no conflicts. I really love QRS. It's short, sweet, to the point. This month it's a cubital tunnel. I did not speak. It's not carpal tunnel. It's that teeny space between your medial epicondyle and the olecranon process that you remember from anatomy class when your anatomy professor had you basically touch your own ulnar nerve and feel the electricity shoot to your medial kind of palm and pinky. So that's that cubital tunnel in there. And the nerve, the ulnar nerve, can get shoved into that space. You can have bony overgrowth. It can become impinged from different reasons. It's the sensory to the fifth finger. and the medial half of the ring finger. So that's where people will be having symptoms. Motor that the nerve provides is what enables you to spread your fingers apart against resistance, not the thumb, but when you ask your patient, hold your fingers wide apart, don't let me squeeze them together. That's your ulnar nerve. And if anyone asks, 70% of entrapment occurs at the arcade of Struthers. I'm going to repeat that. The arcade of Struthers. Chris, I know you have something to say about that eponym.
This is completely new to me, and I absolutely love it. Love it.
I just think those words together are like so fantastic. The arcade of Struthers. Mm-hmm. Man, I hope I get a board question with that. It is so... cubital tunnel is men more than women. It's pain around the medial elbow, numbness of the ring and pinky finger, worse at night, weak grip or pinch strength, worse when you flex the elbow. Physical exam is, you want to first make sure this isn't a neck cervical impingement. Check the intrinsic muscles of the hand. Check passive and active range of motion of the elbow, muscle strength, focus on grip strength, finger resistance. Do a two-point test. You don't get to do that every day, so dust those filaments off if you haven't used them since your neuropractical in PA school. And you want to do a Tinel test. I remember a Tinel for tap, both T's. Tap the ulnar nerve and see if you can reproduce those symptoms. You do need an EMG, electromyography, and get an elbow radiograph to see if there's bone impingement. If the EMG is negative or mild, it's kind of like in carpal tunnel. You just want to brace at night to prevent flexion. But here you're bracing to prevent elbow flexion, and I would not sleep. I would die of insomnia. I can't ever get cubital tunnel impingement because I can't do the bracing. You could also do occupational therapy, and you should reserve surgery for moderate to severe EMG findings. And that's it. There we go. Quick and sweet.
Yep. Yep. Side note, we're actually, they're seeing much more cubital tunnel syndrome now because so many of us are sitting in this position because of smartphones and all of the other things. And, you know, work, especially, I mean, think about it at night when you're, you know, laying in bed, you've got your elbows, you know, crimped up, you're holding your hands, you're walking around. Yeah. I mean, we're just constantly keeping our elbows in a flex position. They're seeing a much bigger uptick in cubital tunnel as a result of that.
And that makes total sense for all T-Rexes.
All right. Last one is the 150 rule to prevent hepatotoxicity from acetaminophen. And this was written by William A. Nicholas and Randy Moore. William is a PA that practices in emergency medicine at MCARE at Baylor Health in Dallas. And he also serves in the Texas Army National Guard. Thank you for your service, William.
Thank you.
Randy Moore also practices at Wellness Point Family Health in Longview, Texas. So just a recap of the 150 rule for acetaminophen toxicity. Just remember that if it's greater than 150 milligrams per kilogram, that is a potentially toxic ingestion. Greater than 150 micrograms per milliliter is the 4-hour acetaminophen level that indicates treatment. And 150 milligrams per kilogram over the first hour is the starting dose for IV and acetylcysteine. So just a quick recap of the pathophysiology of acetaminophen toxicity. So remember that concentrations peak within 90 minutes in the GI tract, and that 90% of acetaminophen metabolites are actually non-toxic. 2% are excreted unchanged in the urine, so that leaves 8% left over, and these are the ones that cause problems. These are metabolized by the cytochrome P450 pathway, and they produce N-acetyl-P-benzoquinone-imine, or NAPQI. This then is metabolized by glutathione in the liver. And the problem is that when the glutathione is depleted, which typically occurs at around 70 to 80%, the NAPQI react with cellular proteins and destroy the hepatocytes, and that's the toxic metabolite that is produced with ingestion. So the stages of acetaminophen toxicity, remember that during the first 24 hours, the patients may have no symptoms or experience just nonspecific symptoms, nausea, vomiting, malaise, diaphoresis, nothing that really makes you think about acetaminophen toxicity. At 24 to 72 hours, signs and symptoms include right upper quadrant pain, elevated transaminases and bilirubin levels. Signs of liver failure typically start to occur after that 72-hour mark and can include lethargy, jaundice, hepatic encephalopathy, and renal failure. And then the final stage, which is usually at the 96-hour mark, the patient will either recover over the next 2 weeks or die. And, you know, it's just, it's a tough, tough condition to catch early. But the bottom line is, and what the authors really recommend, is that the earlier you can intervene, the better. So you need to entertain the idea of this diagnosis. You need to check the levels as quickly as possible, and you need to institute treatment as quickly as possible, with the hopes that then patients will be able to recover from this and not have any permanent hepatic issues or, unfortunately, succumb to their illness. So if you don't deal with acetaminophen toxicity very much, go and read this article. It gives you a really quick breakdown of what you need to know to manage these patients.
That's right. Yeah. That about does it.
That wraps us up.
Hey, did you hear? We're on Twitter.
We are.
We are.
So I am at PA_Madej. Adrian is at the Art of EBM, all one word. JAPA is at JAPACOM. Harrison Reed, our associate editor of JAPA, is at Harrison Reed PA, all one word. Sound and sound engineering is done by myself. And if you haven't subscribed to our iTunes feed or Stitcher at this point, then head on over, give us a rating, and let us know what you think.
Mm-hmm. And we hope you'll come back next month. We'd love to have you join us in May when we're bringing you direct-to-consumer podcasting straight from AAPA in Denver. So the next time you hear from us, we'll be in Denver and bringing you all of that AAPA Denver conference goodness.
Yeah, so if you're going to be at the conference and you see us, please come up and say hello. Let us know how you're either enjoying or not enjoying the podcast. And give us some feedback on how this this podcast is helping your clinical practice.
Yes, please. So until next time.
We'll see you then. Bye.
Bye.